No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So you can call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or we have a chat box, and you can send questions to that, and we'll do our best to answer them. Maria, welcome.
Welcome, Michael. Hi. Has it been busy, but in the District of Columbia, probably more than anywhere, right?
Well, I don't know more than anywhere, but certainly very busy. And tonight, to talk about the unfortunate busyness, and while there's an upside to it as well, I think change is coming. But we have with us tonight Arisha Michelle Hatch, who is Chief of Campaigns for Color of Change. Ms. Hatch leads campaigns on civic engagement, voter rights, criminal justice, and corporate and media accountability. She is a graduate of Stanford University and holds a law degree from the University of California, and we're just so excited to have her. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, absolutely. Let me start by just, for people that don't know what Color of Change is, it's got 1.7 million members and tries to affect change through social media and other things on the internet, as far as I understand it. But please tell us exactly what you do.
Absolutely. Color of Change is one of the largest Black-led racial justice organizations in the country. And we think about our work as giving people easy things to do, simple things to do that are strategic and help change the minds of decision makers in a way that has real-world impacts for Black people, real-world positive impacts for Black people. We do a lot on work on a lot of different issues that impact Black folks. And just in this past 2 weeks, more than 6 million people have taken action with Color of Change to demand justice for Ahmaud Arbery, demand justice for George Floyd, to demand justice for Breonna Taylor. We are trying to keep their stories alive in the hopes that the system has enough time to do what it's supposed to do.
Well, I just think that's amazing. And I think it's so important to keep those stories alive, because we keep on coming back to the same place, don't we? And things don't change. And part of it, I think, is that we forget, unfortunately. Let me start out by asking you this question. I've been in civil rights work for most of my adult life, and I posted a few things on Facebook this week because I'm a diabetic. I'm not out there marching with people. I feel bad about it. I feel like I should be. So I'm trying to communicate as best I can. And one thing that surprised me, I've gotten a lot of positive feedback for what I've written, but I've gotten a couple of young people who have objected to some of the things I've said. And upon reflection, I think it's because they feel that I can't feel their pain. As an old elected white guy, I just can't see where they're coming from. And I get that, but where that leaves me is I really don't know what I can do to help. Can you give me some insight into that?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think what we've seen at Color of Change is that for the last several weeks, the entire country and all over the globe, people are engaged in conversations about the impact of over-policing and mass incarceration on Black communities. And, you know, for Black folks, although there are periods of time where there are not videos circulating on social media that shows many of these violent encounters with police or with vigilantes, as we saw in the case of Ahmaud Arbery's murder. Although, you know, the nation or the world doesn't get to see these videos caught on camera often, we are living with in this sort of hostile environment on a daily basis. And so I think a lot of the pain that myself and many of my friends and family felt this week, grieving after we sort of watched that video, and then recognizing that for so many other people are just beginning to feel a sense of outrage about this moment. And so I know folks have definitely struggled with that. What we also know is that since the beginning of the movement for Black Lives, when Michael Brown was killed and Ferguson protesters stayed in the street for more than 14 days, as a Black civil rights movement, our demands have become more specific and much more clear. We demand to have prosecutors who are accountable to Black communities. We expect that when police are wrong, that they will be fired or charged. When they are wrong, we expect to have prosecutors that treat kids like kids and don't prosecute petty offenses. We also expect to have local governments who are thinking very critically about how their budgets reflect their intention around safety and justice in their communities all across the country, even in the midst of a pandemic where a healthcare system is under strain, even in the midst of a pandemic where schools and education systems are trying to reimagine what education looks like in this country. Both of these things and so many other important programs remain underfunded while police receive billions and billions of dollars. And so in addition to keeping George and Ahmaud's and Breonna's stories alive in conversation, we are also asking folks like you to call on local officials to reassess their budgets and to move more money away from police departments and policing and into community programs that actually improve the lives of Black people.
Maria, do you have a question?
I sure do. One of the things that I was impressed with was the story about getting Zoom to hire a chief diversity officer. And I participated in a Zoom this week that was on the fourth anniversary of the passing of Muhammad Ali. And it was specific to his activism and all that went into his career. And at the very end of it, 3 minutes left, we were Zoom bombed, and the N-word was said and printed in all caps in the chat side. And most of the participants were Black in this symposium. And I have read about it, and it's the first time I've been a part of it. And I was curious what you can say, because I know Color of Change was involved in helping Zoom do that for them in terms of diversity.
Right. Corporate accountability is a big part of our work, and asking corporations, who are some of the most powerful decision makers in our country and in our world, to consider the impacts of their technology, their products, et cetera, on Black folks. And so it's really important to have diversity officers with inside corporations that are thinking about the impacts on people of color and other marginalized folks. So that when unexpected things like this happen, that there can be a quick discourse within a company and decisions, creative decisions made about how to make sure that folks aren't feeling terrorized while they're on a Zoom call trying to connect with friends or family or coworkers during this time. And so, part of what we did was ask Zoom to reconsider their policies and reconsidering their hiring patterns because, you know, too often, whether it's on a Zoom call or whether it's when you're shopping or whether it's when you're social distancing in the park with a face mask, too often Black folks experience a level of discrimination that is a constant reminder of the bias and inequity that we face.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I found most intriguing about what you do, this idea that you have to change the image that America has of Black people. I think that's so important. You know, there's the classic instance of, I can't remember this Black actress's name, but she played Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek, which was a popular show when I was a kid. And she said she took the job. She didn't want the job, but she took it because Dr. King told her to take it, said that we needed to change the image of, get away from the Andy, you know, the Amos and Andy image of Black people in the media, and we needed to have more positive images of Black people. And that's so important. So how do you guys work? I know you do work in the media. How do you work in the media, and what changes are we seeing?
Sure, and representation definitely matters. And what Color of Change has been working with Hollywood folks to do, content creators, writers for televisions and movies, is to really take a hard look at the types of representations of Black people that we're seeing on our screens, because there is so much research that reinforces the idea that media enables and reinforces biases about Black people that maybe were over-emotional or too angry or violent. It also reinforces and misinforms people about the way the criminal justice system works. And so we're not necessarily just looking for positive images. What we're looking for are humane images, full images, complex characters that actually have backstories. Too often, Black folks are just sort of the sidekicks that, you know, learn nothing about their parents or their jobs or the challenges that they face. And so we're working with a lot of folks to push for those sorts of representations. Recently, we worked with USA to do a study of policing shows. And what we found was that overwhelmingly these shows showed Black people and other people of color in power in ways that we know that they aren't in real life. What the study showed was that oftentimes violence by police officers was glamorized. What we also found was that many of the people that were responsible for these representations, many of the writers in the writers' rooms, were all white. And so we've been working to push back against some of those representations in those shows, also working with writers' rooms to improve not only their diversity, but what we, in the hopes that we see something more realistic on screen.
So, Arisha, can you go into how you actually do that? Because you did that with, for example, Saturday Night Live, and then you're working on getting Netflix to be more representative of how Black folks are viewed. How do you do it?
We use an inside-outside strategy. So we work to develop relationships with some of the decision-makers that we want to influence. We're also engaging our members, the 1.7 million folks that you referenced earlier, now actually 5 or 6 million folks over the course of the last 6 weeks. And we engage them in a conversation about the change that we want to see and the decision maker that is responsible for that change. And we try to bring our members' voices to those decision makers. You know, so several years ago, when SNL announced that they were hiring a new slate of actors, and none of them were black women or black people, which meant that for the first time in years, there would not be a black woman on Saturday Night Live. We pushed back. We engaged in a conversation with the producers. We engaged in a conversation with our network, with the network. And we also asked our members to sign petitions and show up at rallies to push for that change. And, you know, in that specific case, we got a win, and I think it improved the show tremendously.
And it's amazing to me that we're having these conversations in this day and age, that we aren't open-minded enough to do that automatically, that we have to be cajoled or pushed or coerced or have petitions signed. And so you're proving that the Color of Change is as essential now as you were when you were founded.
And let me just add to that, that I think that this is so important, because I think that people in general do not go in search of the truth. I think they go in search of evidence that the prejudices they hold are valid. You know, I think they seek out things that support what they believe rather than seek out the truth. So I just can't tell you how important I think the work that you're doing to change these images, especially since we all watch too much TV in life, how important that absolutely is. Let me ask you a question. I looked at your website, and there's a guy called the Chief of Marketing and Storytelling Officer. Anybody in my family will tell you that I tell the same old stories over over and over and over again, and that's my dream job. My dream job is to be the Chief of Storytelling. Tell me exactly what does this young man do?
Yeah, it's definitely a cool title. In other companies or organizations, they might be the Chief Marketing Officer. But Rashid Shabazz, who you're referencing, our Chief Storytelling and Media Officer, helps to drive communications for the organization. He also leads a department of folks that are developing content that hopefully can change hearts and minds around so many of the issues that we care about. And he's also charged with telling the story of Color of Change. You mentioned, you know, Color of Change was founded in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina 15 years ago, with two folks sending out an email to a list of 1,000 of their closest friends. And now that email list has 6 or 7 million people on it who together can call for change in moments of crisis. And who can demand systemic change and a better country. So we continue to do that work of helping people respond, and Rashid's team is a big part of telling the story so that Color of Change can continue to build the power that it needs to win real-world change for black people.
Well, and we've seen this working. Right. In the case of Ahmaud Arbery, for example, 2.5 months go by and there are no charges. And then this video comes out and there's this this uprising on social media. And all of a sudden, these three rednecks who were involved in this situation are charged. So what a powerful tool that is. And, you know, I think, again, I don't know what to call the situation with George Floyd, whether to call it an execution, a lynching, or whatever it is. But I've got to tell you, 66 years old, and I grew up in a bad neighborhood, and I've never seen anything like that. That was the most horrific thing, to watch that man slowly die while, you know, these officers stood around and didn't even seem to be engaged. They were, you know, they could have cared less. And it's obviously it's been a great motivator. So do you think that social media, is this one of the underpinnings to the change that, that I think is coming. Is this something that we need to use more to get positive change, especially for Black people in America?
Absolutely. Social media and cell phones, I think, have been incredibly important parts of the broader movement for Black lives. And I agree, the video of George Floyd and so many of the videos are absolutely horrific. And I know that it is hard for people to imagine that these things also happen off camera, but they do. And they're probably worse than mm-hmm. this moment. And so it is so important when we actually do have this evidence, you know, this system, this systemically racist system that we are often talking about as organizers, can be so hard to prove. And so while these videos are triggering and induce trauma, and, you know, for not only the people viewing them, but also for the families of their loved ones, they have been the only evidence of, that we have had of a system that we've been complaining about for generations.
Maria, do you,
I just have
I don't
to
want
say,
to monopolize the time. If, go ahead.
I appreciate that, Michael, and I don't want to interrupt, but I have to say, as a Hispanic woman who has had my own, nothing compared to what people of color experience, but over the years, how people have judged me based on what they've heard about my demographics, that because I present white, I still get to be, quote, safe and pass through the system. But having seen this happen, I not only have I been shaken to the core, to tears, to trembling, to 46 seconds in silence earlier this week, that I am touched finally that it seems that white people are equally shaken and disturbed. And that seems to be the changing point, if you will. And I don't know if you would agree with the statement that maybe now, finally, something will be done because white people are getting involved.
It does feel different. I will say that. What do you think, Arisha?
I'm hopeful. Someone said to me this week that, and they were quoting someone that I'll forget, but that you can't tell a tipping point until after. But just as traumatized and sickened and outraged as you were seeing those videos, I think I was equally, released, not the right word, but I was so thankful to see so many images of our allies putting their lives literally on the line to say, this isn't right, this isn't fair. We need a different way. And, you know, images of, you know, protests in Portland and in Idaho really struck a nerve with me. And, you know, it has been a reminder, even in this tragic moment, that we've done a lot of work. We've made a lot of progress. We still have a lot of work to do to pivot those into the real systemic changes that actually change policing and change incarceration and change the wealth gaps and other disparities that Black people face. But, you know, I remain hopeful that we're closer than we have been before.
Well, just as an example, Michael, because Arisha, since you're in California, you might know Simi Valley, which is where the Rodney King trial exonerated them in 1992, and that set off all the riots. The Simi Valley is pretty lily white. They just had a rally yesterday that was attended by thousands of people. Some people came from outside Simi Valley, and they marched to City Hall, and it was led by two 16-year-olds. And for that to happen there, that, to me, seems that this is becoming a game changer.
I hope so. We've experienced so much resistance over the last several years to, like, this basic concept that Black lives matter, whether it's, you know, folks saying blue lives matter or all lives matter, or, you know, the NFL punishing Colin Kaepernick for, you know, a simple protest. It's been, I am thankful to see so many folks speaking out and saying this should no longer be the status quo. We demand a new normal in this country.
You know, what I've seen, though, and again, this concerns me, is that I've seen some backlash from young people. You may have noticed that in Washington, D.C., we just had really big protests in Washington, D.C., and the other night, the president pushed a bunch of protesters out of the way aggressively so he could go have a photo op. And in response, our mayor, on a three-block piece of 16th Street that butts up against the White House, wrote, "Black Lives Matter." A lot of us saw this as a really assertive move to say to the president, hey, look, you may live here, but this is still our town. Mm-hmm. Yet Black Lives Matter in D.C. came out and criticized the mayor for doing it because they said, you know, it's nice to talk the talk, but she really needs to walk the walk. And, you know, we have an old saying in politics, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But that doesn't seem to hold here. Am I misreading this somehow?
I haven't seen the full criticisms, but, you know, just sort of hearing the context that you're providing, you know, the mayor has power right, to make changes around our system of policing and our system of incarceration. And so symbolic gestures are amazing. I personally love, like, trolling the ultimate troll this week. Sure. I love the idea of, you know, people looking out and having to sort of see and contemplate this idea that Black Lives Matter. But she has real power and authority, and the protesters and organizers who have been doing this work for years want to see actual change and not just symbolic gestures. And they're right to critique that. They're right to critique that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that people are getting tired of the platitudes that, as politicians, we always put out there. And then they don't see anything change. So,
but didn't she also rename the street to the White House as Black Lives Matter Plaza?
Yes, she renamed that particular area around where the protesters were pushed out. Mm-hmm. She did name that, which is in her power. You know, there's a lot of things in Washington, D.C., which the mayor has no power over. For example, the influx of federal troops into the city. She really didn't have any power over that. So where she's kind of maneuvering, it seems, in the gray area where she can to stand up to the bullying. And that's had mixed results. I mean, some people have praised it. And like Arisha, as somebody who ran a consulting firm for 25 years where we did political PR, I love that sort of thing. I think it's a really positive thing. But I also understand why people, you know, are skeptical of, you know, they don't want us to go away. And when the paint on the street is worn off, to have things be the same. Can I ask you what's going on with Breonna Taylor, which is also just a horrible story? Mm-hmm. Do you know, have people been charged in that? Nobody's been charged yet, have they?
No one's been charged yet. Last I heard, I mean, news changes quickly.
Right.
It's just, you know, another example of the types of violence that we face. And, you know, as a Black woman who, you know, does organizing in this space, you know, who made time to go out and protest, this weekend, I am also reminded that there are so many folks who don't get the big protest, who, you know, the media, you know, doesn't lead with the story of their lives or their murder. You know, so many black women, so many trans folks who there isn't this public outcry for. But we believe that because there are so many people who are just outraged by what happened to George Floyd, that this is also a moment where we can hopefully piggyback justice for many of the folks that have been ignored.
And how do we change that? I mean, you know, part of my thing, Arisha, is that I grew up, I was an orphan. I dropped out of high school. I got into trouble with the police as a young guy, mostly just stupid stuff. But I grew up in an all-white, rich county, and there were a lot of people that stepped in and helped me and changed, you know, helped me turn my life around so that I had a master's degree, started my own business, got elected United States Senator. And there's part of me that fully understands that if I had been African American, I don't think these things would happen for me. So I don't know whether I call it survivor's guilt or, you know, the fact that I feel lucky. But how do we impress that upon white people that don't have that experience? They don't interact very often with black people. Even in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., you know, we're very liberal. We may be the most liberal jurisdiction in America, and we're still very segregated. We have a city that has a majority black population. Very few black people live in my neighborhood. So how do we change this? How do we change this perception?
I think it's about continuing to tell, just like you did, your story and having those sorts of courageous conversations with a set of folks that you know have not experienced the same diversity that you've experienced or experienced the same sort of barriers that you've experienced. And so, you know, the story I hear that you tell is about having to overcome a lot of obstacles, but still recognizing that there was privilege, that there were moments when you needed it that you got the benefit of the doubt. And so many other black people and brown people don't, and women don't get that benefit of the doubt in so many circumstances. And that's what we're trying to change. That's what it means to be fully human in the eyes of others. It's that you get that benefit of the doubt. You're allowed the opportunity to sort of capitalize and be your best version of yourself, that you're allowed to flourish, and that you're also allowed to be a kid and make mistakes as an adult. And that you are allowed to be resilient and better than you are on your worst day.
Well, you know, for me, I just want to add to that, that I think the first serious realization of this came when I got a GED and started college, and I got an orphan scholarship because there were no orphans at my college. It was a community college. And I got a scholarship just for being an orphan. And then I went to the University of Maryland, where I got my bachelor's and my master's degree, and I applied for a similar thing, and they kind of laughed at me because they had inner city black kids from Baltimore and Washington, and they said basically to me, look, we have orphans here that are raising six younger brothers and sisters. you just don't get to the back of the line. but you just don't qualify. So I had a lot of advantage and a lot of help, and I really hope that we can make people see those things. Let me ask you, because America has grown up as a segregated society. When I was a kid, there was still great segregation. I remember going with my family on a trip to New Orleans at 8 years old and seeing white and colored water fountains, having restaurants where African Americans couldn't eat. Since this, there's been this segregation, and we've grown up with two kind of separate cultures in this country, a white culture and a black culture. How much of this do you think is our misunderstanding of the other culture? I mean, do white people really understand the way black people feel?
I'm not sure. What I do know is that while we have lived very segregated lives, and there continues to be extreme segregation in many areas of our lives, our cultures also interact with each other. Like, black folks have contributed to American culture. There are things that black folks take from white culture. I'm not sure. I think, we've been trained for so many generations to fear each other. White folks in particular have been trained to not only fear, but to think that black folks are less than human, in the same way that men have been trained that women are somewhat inferior in different levels. And it will take generations, and it takes a lot of personal work to decolonize our thinking in that sort of way. But I'd like to believe that if we can work on our empathy, work on understanding that someone from a different race or a different gender or a different sexuality is still a human being that has similar yearnings and strivings as we do, that hearts and minds can soften and change, and that people will be able to tell a story about how they've changed their mind, about how they previously believed and moved through the world was wrong, and the benefits of being more open-minded.
So there's also something we've discussed on our program when we talked about reparations, that there is generational trauma that exists and that's psychologically documented. And I don't know how we go about undoing that, because I know in communities of color, sometimes seeking assistance for psychological distress is viewed as a weakness. And so, because Michael was also talking about people look to find what it is that will validate what it is that they already feel, which is called confirmation bias. So we've got a whole bunch of factors in play here. And do you have suggestions about how that might help people help themselves with these wounds that they may or may not acknowledge, but do indeed exist?
I think reparations are absolutely essential. And when we think and talk about reparations, we talk about the U.S. government sort of acknowledging the role that it's played in creating wealth disparities and educational disparities and disparities in the criminal justice system, and actually acknowledging and working to repair and heal those wounds. And this has been done all across the country after injustice. Black folks in this country have survived slavery. We've survived Jim Crow. We continue to survive a criminal justice system and a healthcare system and an economic justice system that continues to be hostile towards us. And so we are deserving of repair. And I think until there's that public acknowledgement by the government, backed by real resources that actually decrease those disparities, shrink those disparities, we're going to continue to see these sorts of videos.
Let me ask you, one of the fears that I have in the middle of this coronavirus thing is that I see so many young people out there. Both my daughters have been protesting, and I see so many young black people out there. Is there a way that we can move these protests on more onto the internet so that in the end we don't see black people suffer even more by spreading the coronavirus amongst themselves while they're out there seeking social justice? Is there any strategy we can use to say to people, we need to move this to the internet, move this and make it safer? Is that something that you guys consider, or is the presence of people in the streets so important that we really can't interfere with that?
I Color of Change works all the time to give people things that they can do from their home that we believe add up to the change that we want to see in the world. But and we were, of course, stunned to see images of so many people leaving their homes at this time. For there have been so many hypotheses about, you know, what it looks like to reopen America, whether it would be schools or, all sorts of things about, whether or not people would feel comfortable moving out of their homes. And for this to be the thing, the first thing that we see en masse, was truly breathtaking. And so, there was no moment where we at Color of Change, or I think any of the other civil rights organizations that we work with, felt like we had the power to sort of control it. I think the protests were about George Floyd and about Breonna and Ahmaud, but they were, also about the pushback from the Trump administration and from so many other police departments. There's nothing, anyone could say. People felt so impassioned to go out on the streets. Our hope was to sort of channel that energy and anger into a clear set of demands. First that the officers be fired, then that they be charged, and hopefully that there's justice. And now, in this moment, pivoting to demand, asking mayors all across the country to reassess their local budgets and move more money into health care, mental care, and education and out of police departments.
I'm obligated to tell you this. Let me tell you that I've looked at your website and I am very impressed with the work you're doing, and I'm a big fan. And by the time we end the show, I want you to tell me how I become one of the 6 million people that subscribe
and our listeners.
Yeah, and our listeners. But I have to tell you, I didn't see anything about the fact that 350,000 African Americans in the District of Columbia have no voice. Have you guys discussed this issue? I'm sure you're aware that in D.C., I'm elected like other United States senators, but I'm not allowed to vote. I'm not allowed to participate in Congress. Our mayor doesn't have control of the city. The president does, and Congress does. Are you guys interested in getting involved in making the people of the District of Columbia equal?
Absolutely. I'm quarantining in Southern California, but I recently relocated to D.C., and so I definitely have skin in the game. You tell me, who has the power in this situation? What do we do next? What are the next steps to push?
The ultimate power resides in Congress, because the Constitution of the United States says that they shall have exclusive power in all cases whatsoever, exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the District of Columbia. So, for example, one of the things that promoted the Black Lives Matter artwork on the street was the fact that the president could call in federal troops from all over the country without any
permission.
Any interference or permission from the people of Washington, D.C. And not only that, when they were in the district, they would be completely under his control and not under the control of. We can't even pass a law in the District of Columbia if Congress prohibits it, and we cannot even spend our own tax money. The President of the United States signs off on the federal budget and the D.C. budget. They're the only two budgets he signs off on. So our solution is to become a state, because all states enter the union on equal footing. So if we get become a state, we become, we're just like everybody else, and we cut out a little enclave, which is still the federal government, and all the rest of the area where the 718,000 people live and where you're living now would become the new state. So we have legislation in the House with enough co-sponsors to make us a state. It will die the moment it enters the Republican-controlled Senate, but statehood is has been the path that we have chosen to try to rectify the situation. And we need allies. We need national allies, because most people across America don't understand that we're in the situation that we're in, which is one of the reasons that Maria and I have this radio show. So how do we get an organization like yours involved in our fight?
I mean, I think you can always reach out or others. You know, D.C. is so important in terms of Black political power. And, you know, we deserve representation just as folks in Puerto Rico deserve representation and so many other places. And so, you know, it's a fight that I think that we'd be happy to take on. And recognizing that, you know, some of the work that we're doing through Color of Change PAC to elect a more progressive Senate, also we hope both at the federal level and the work that we're doing at the state level, we also hope that that can lead to changes around a number of different issues that really affect Black political power.
Does Joe Biden need to pick a Black person as a running mate, do you think?
I don't know. You know, that's his choice. And, you know, he obviously has to pick someone that he can work with and that brings a level of balance to the ticket. And ultimately, he has to own it. I have appreciated him. And I think it's, you know, I was thinking this other day, as I was reading an article of the list of women that are being vetted by the campaign, like how extraordinary and history-making is it that we know that there will be a woman vice president and that we are seeing these long lists of women that are incredibly qualified to lead alongside him. I absolutely believe that there are several strong Black women candidates.
Me too. Yeah, it's a tough question.
We'll be waiting.
Absolutely. Maria, go ahead.
So, Arisha, with Roger Goodell, who runs the NFL, making a statement on Friday, basically giving atonement that the NFL didn't respond appropriately, do you think your Give Cap a Job campaign is going to get some momentum with that?
I hope so. You know, we've been in conversations and pushing back on the NFL for years now. We were surprised to see his statement.
Without mentioning Colin Kaepernick I don't know if that's because of the repercussions, but nevertheless, everybody is speculating. A job for 4 years. He's not getting any younger. So, you know, something needs to happen quickly.
Yeah. I mean, we are hopeful. I hope he's hopeful. Certainly, the statement by the NFL is a testament to the organizing work that so many players, mostly Black players, have led over the years. Despite being put in very difficult, challenging, career-threatening circumstances. And so, you know, I was a little bit annoyed to see the statement because as people were complaining about protests in the streets over the last several weeks. Colin Kaepernick was the one that, you know, had signaled and was being a symbol and being very clear about what peaceful protest looks like. But I think we're hopeful that someone will give him a shot in the league, and that this is, just isn't some sort of PR move by the NFL, because there is so much outrage in this moment.
Well, let me just give you maybe a tip here. You know, we fought for years. We had one of the biggest racists in the history of the National Football League, a guy that named George Marshall, who owned the Washington Redskins. We were the last team in the NFL to have a black player, the last team. And the only reason we ever got a black player is because when they built RFK Stadium, which was built with government money, the federal government told Marshall that he couldn't go into the stadium unless he had a black player. So he hired a guy named Bobby Mitchell, who became a Hall of Famer and one of the greatest players that the team ever had. But we still have a racism problem with the name of the team, as you probably know, and a lot of people fight that. So maybe somebody should call up the owner of the Washington Redskins and suggest that he could heal a little bit by giving Colin Kaepernick a job. And as a Redskin fan, I would be happy to see a guy with his talent on the field for our team who hasn't been doing very well lately. But
yeah, after they changed the name of their team.
I know. They have to change it. It's horrible. It's horrible. Yeah. But now for the single most important thing, Arisha, how do people join your organization? Because we're running out of time. Give us your website. Tell us how people can hook up with you and get involved.
Yeah, the easiest way to join is to text the word demands with an S to 55156. That's demands to 55156. This is one of our the ways that you can get on our email list, and we'll send you emails and keep you updated about the different campaigns that that we're running. And specifically, you'll see, we'll give you immediate information about the types of demands that we're asking for as a movement, given the moment that we're in. So that's one way. You can also go to colorofchange.org and put your email address in, and we'll get you on our list and start sending you emails, petitions to sign.
Well, let me just tell you that, first of all, thank you again for being on our show. And to tell you, as an old guy in Washington, D.C., that's very concerned about all this, talking to people like you give me great hope for the future, people who are brilliant and engaged and want to make a better America for all of us. So thank you for the work you do. Maria, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you. Arisha, is there a way that we can get involved other than signing petitions or adding our names to your email list? Is there an act, like, when you're looking to do campaigns, say like with the SNL and getting people of color on the cast, do you go to your members and ask, does somebody have no introductions? Like you said, you need to meet with stakeholders. Do you ask for arrangements? Are you so entrenched that you don't need those kinds of introductions? What can we do other than just giving our names?
Yeah, absolutely. We're always working to build relationships across different industries. Folks are doing a lot of things. Signing a petition is one way, and sort of like the first way I think folks can experience and participate with us. But the asks get higher from there. And so there are people all across the country that have joined neighborhood teams, neighborhood squads, we call them. They're devising their own local campaigns, keeping pressure. They're also doing community service events to empower Black joy. They're showing up and checking in on each other. They're making sure that Black folks participate in the census and will participate in the upcoming election. They're making phone calls and sending text messages, all sorts of things. But going to the website or texting demands to 55156 is, I think, the best entry point in. But there's tons of ways to get involved.
Perfect.
Well, you have a new contact with the non-voting United States Senate from Washington, D.C. So if there's anything I can do for you or your organization, please let us know. Again, thank you for being on the show. You know, we hope you'll come back again sometime as we progress and hopefully move towards a changing America that serves all of the citizens better than it has in the past, especially African Americans. So thank you. And we leave you with the song. Yeah, I'm sorry. We leave you with the song tonight. We always leave you with the song. And this goes out to Arisha and Color of Change. I was gonna do the classic Sam Cooke Change Gonna Come, because I love that song, but I came up with one that I think is more appropriate. Here's a song from The Police, Rehumanize Yourself. Thanks, America.
Give the people their right to vote.